Okay, give you a little heads up today. My sermon is more intellectual than it is, you know, kind of rah-rah feeling sort of a sermon. So I just warn you right away about that. So I give you permission to, as you look to your neighbor, if they seem to be nodding off or, you know, drooping their eyes or something, feel free to go over there and pinch them, a good pinch, okay? Keep them awake. And I'll try to make this as painless as possible, but I think it's good sometimes to have our brains challenged. By the end of the sermon, I hope that your brain hurts. Okay? Not that your heart is hurting. I hope your heart will get bigger, just like the Grinch's. But I want your brain maybe is going to hurt a little bit. And that's okay, because we need to stretch our brain. So we start out in John chapter 18, beginning in verse 33. It says, Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews? Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked, "or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this very reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" Pilate asked. With this he went out again into the Jews. "I find no basis to charge any charge against him. But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover." Pilate asked, "What is truth?" We'll talk about that today. If you're like most people, you probably wondered a time or two about how our culture and society has arrived at the place we now find ourselves. Think about the radical changes we have seen compared to previous generations. There has been social change. We went from typical two-parent homes with the father being the major breadwinner to single-parent homes with mothers advancing to CEO status of major corporations. It's true. You can see that happening. Not to say there's anything wrong with that as far as the women advancing. There has been moral change. We went from prohibition of alcohol back in the late 20s to now allowing legalized gambling, gay marriage, and abortion on demand. That's what I would call significant change, moral change. There has been religious change. We went from mandating prayer in public schools to now disallowing religious symbols on virtually all government property. We've seen that happen, haven't we? I briefly described these changes separately, but we all know they're all interconnected, right? The moral, the social, religious. Along with this religious evolution, this past century was also characterized by an infusion of dozens of different religions and beliefs, including even non-Western religious teachings like yoga or Hinduism or Transcendental meditation. I don't even know what that is, but I've heard of it, which has now become mainstream in our society today. Back in the old days, I'm not going to say the good old days, I'm going to say the old days, it was easy to criticize and condemn the way others thought about these things because, quite frankly, they were foreign to us. They were unfamiliar to us, these concepts. Not long ago, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam were considered by the West to be barbaric and evil religions held by uneducated, malicious, and immoral people groups. That's how we saw them. I don't mean to kick the Bible, but I just wrote it. Okay. But now that the Hindus and the Buddhists and adherents of other religions, they have become a regular part of our culture, haven't they? As a matter of fact, they become our neighbors. I remember it wasn't that long ago, we went down, my daughter Courtney and I went down to Dearborn. We were checking out this ministry that I heard about and I want to go see it. And it was just so interesting driving around that neighborhood and seeing how they were carrying out their religious, their traditions down there. But when we realize that they are neighbors and they are in our contemporary culture, we find out that most of them are no different than we are. They are very kind and generous and they're friendly folk. Furthermore, they are very well educated about their religion and they're devoted to their views as much as Christians are devoted to our views. Maybe more so in a lot of cases. They are more strongly devoted. Well, here's what I want to talk about today. We have our views. We have our moral views, our social views, our religious views. And they have theirs. And many of our views are significantly different from their views. This, in a nutshell, is what is called pluralism. Ever hear the word pluralism? It's the idea that there are diverse beliefs that coexist together. And we see that, although my one daughter, Courtney, went to college, so I'm sure she was exposed to different views that she probably hadn't run into yet. But you don't have to go to the university to do this. You can just go down to the store next door and talk to somebody there. In the past, people held the idea that if two different views contradicted one another, then one must be true and one must be false. You know what that's called? When you have two different views, one's right and one's wrong, that's called absolutism. Absolutism. So the question is today is, can pluralism, all these views mingling together, can it coexist with absolutism? In other words, should we Christians stubbornly hold to absolutism and continue to believe that our views are right and that all the other views are wrong, especially concerning Jesus? Should we ditch this idea of absolutism, which many believe to be narrow and arrogant and excessively rigid? Should we ditch that and agree that everyone has his or her own truth? As the slogan goes, to each his own. As a pastor, my job in the church is to help Christians go about working to build belief based on truth. Thus, that is the reason for my sermon today, a kind of continuation of this idea of some assembly required. We have to build our faith. We have to build it on truth. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Paul exhorts Christians to be careful how to build. No one can lay a foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. The Apostle Paul went on to say, he had vivid imagery, and he said, you are like living stones. We are being built into a spiritual house. Christ is the cornerstone of that building in which we are a part. Notice that Peter and Paul agree that our faith must be built on Christ Jesus alone, who declared himself to be the truth, the way, the truth, the life. Well, a building project of this magnitude is never ending, is it? It's sort of like road construction in Michigan, okay? It's never ending. We will never have everything figured out. Some questions in life will be just too big. The answer is too complex for our finite human minds to fully comprehend. Nonetheless, I believe, and we can be assured, we can find truth and be certain about many things in life, including some of the most fundamental things in life, including the idea of knowing our eternal destiny of our souls. That's very important. That's the number one question. What is the eternal destiny of our souls? And we can be assured of this for one reason, and that is God revealed these truths to us. And so the question becomes, how do we go about helping others come around to our way of thinking, believing that Jesus Christ truly is the way, the truth, and the life? No one comes to the Father except through him. Francis Schaeffer, he is one of the most influential Christian thinkers of the 20th century. He pointed out years ago that the crucial starting point in trying to dialogue with others who have different viewpoints, different perspective, is we have to find the common ground in that, correct? To begin where everyone can agree. And this common ground, he argued, begins with one of the most fundamental laws of logic and reality. It's called the law of non-contradiction. We'll talk more about that. But this is the common ground, because it doesn't matter what culture you come from, it doesn't matter what society or religious background you come from, once it is carefully analyzed, we should all come to the same conclusion, agreeing that the law of non-contradiction is universally true. So we begin on common ground, and that's extremely important. Once a person can see the rational undeniability of this basic law of thought, and how it demonstrates that absolute truth is correct, that there is an absolute truth, and it's not relative. Now, the relative being, you have your truth, I have mine. That's called relative truth. We can have different truths, basically. In other words, the law of non-contradiction proves, for example, despite the fact that there are many religious viewpoints out there, they cannot all be right, given that they have contradictory claims. And that's what we find in religion. Either one of them is true and all the others are false, or all of them are false and something else is true that we haven't discovered yet. Once a person sees that the truth is absolute, it's like a lighthouse. It's solid structure. It's immovable. It's not relative. In other words, it's not booing, it's not going up and down and to and fro. Then we can move on to the next logical question, that is, what is the truth? Jesus, before he was crucified, he stood before Pontius Pilate, and Pontius asked him that very seemingly simple and innocent question. He said, what is truth? He said that he was questioning that way back then, 2,000 years ago. Many of us are questioning it today. And the answer, at first glance, it seems so obvious as to be even worth mentioning. After all, we all know what truth is, don't we? Or do we? We use the word truth countless times throughout our lives. And so you'd think we do know what it means. But on further inspection, the question turns out to be more difficult to answer than one might suppose. Maybe it's not so simple as we thought it was. Historically, there have been a fairly consistent view of what truth is. The view even has a name. They call it the correspondence view, or the correspondence theory of truth. Basically, it says is that what we say lines up with reality. It was described first by a Greek philosopher. It was Plato, I guess. Plato. He offered a description. He said, the truth claim is the one that states the way things are. And a false claim is a statement that says it's different than what they are. That's kind of basic, right? That's a no-nonsense description of what truth means. Most people up until the late 19th century agreed with it. Truth then was understood to be kind of agreement with reality. It corresponded with reality. What you stated was what reality was. Consider this true statement, that the Earth is 94 million miles away from the sun. We're not going to argue that today, are we? The scientists have come up with that. Here's another true statement. The steam thing always goes off at exactly this time, every Sunday morning, when I'm up here preaching. Amen. If it didn't go off, I would feel lost, I suppose. But here's what happened. By the end of the 19th century, there was new views and theories about truth began to unfold, and this correspondence theory that I just talked about, it was scrutinized. And for example, one central criticism was that What do we do with statements that cannot be scientifically verified? In other words, it was postulated that something could only be true if it could be verified by observation and experimentation. Those things were considered true. Anything else, well, that's up for grabs now. Consider the claim, it is true that God of the Bible exists. You can't scientifically verify that. Is God of the Bible really there? How can you ever prove such a claim from an experiment or scientific standpoint? We cannot see God in the heavens, even with the most powerful telescope. And since this claim about God cannot be verified scientifically, the argument goes that, well, no one can really know if it is true or not. This criticism of this type of correspondence of truth was so significant that some of the scholars in the early 20th century attempted to eliminate these kinds of religious claims altogether, arguing they were meaningless since there was no way to verify between the statement and reality. Well, anybody confused yet? Anybody, is their head starting to hurt? Okay, we haven't even gotten started here, okay? Maybe you're just bored. I would prefer you to be confused rather than bored, because bored means you just checked out, okay? Confused means you're still trying to think about this, even though you may not get it, okay? Confusion, boredom, I don't know if you can cure that. Confusion, maybe we can. So what do we do with these statements that include unverifiable claims, like the one about God's existence? One approach was to develop a new theory of truth. That's what they do. Hey, we can't understand this, so let's make a new theory. And so they came up with something called the coherent view of truth. Basically, that means you take your set of beliefs, and if the truth claims connect with your belief system, then they're true. They are coherent within your belief system. That makes it true. Here's an example. You say to yourself, my belief is that all human beings are essentially good. They are not sinful. So, based on that, you could say, Jesus did not have to die on the cross, because there's no need for Jesus to die on the cross, because when he died on the cross, he was trying to save us from our sins, right? But if all mankind is inherently good, there's no need for Christ to die on the cross. There, and the coherence view of truth would say, well, that's true. It lines up with your belief system. Now that sounds pretty good. You could say, and from that you could say, well, that's great. That means everybody can have their own truth. And we all can get along. Wouldn't that, yippee, we all can get along now. We all, your truth, you have your truth, I have my truth, and everything is great. Well, that sounds good, doesn't it? But the coherence view of truth is unsatisfactory. It is actually an untenable view of truth. For example, fairy tales can be logically consistent within their system. Pooh and Piglet and Tigger, they did go for those walks in 100-mile woods, 100-acre woods. They went on those great adventures. But guess what? They're merely fictitious characters. And in that system, yes, they did that. But they're fictitious, so it's not true. Sorry to break it to you, kids, for all it. And anybody else out there listening who believes, you know, that sort of stuff. Second, people can make up lies that are completely consistent within their perspective, but they don't match reality. I remember the time I had to explain to my mom how this candy bar got into my pocket when I was at the Five and Dime. I came up with a great story that was logically consistent, but unfortunately, it was a complete lie. Finally, the biggest problem with the coherent view of truth is that it violates that law I talked about earlier, the law of non-contradiction. This is incredibly important in logic, as important as the law of gravity is to physics. The formula is sometimes expressed as this. A cannot equal not A. And you just plug things into the equation. Red cannot be blue. If A is the case, it cannot be that non-A is also the case. If A is true, then not A cannot be true. The point is simply this, that two contradictory claims cannot both be true. Here's an example. Mount Rushmore is in South Dakota. This is, we'll call that A. If we plug it into the mathematical equation or logic equation, then it reads, if it is the case that Mount Rushmore is in South Dakota, then it cannot be the case that Mount Rushmore is not located in South Dakota. Mount Rushmore cannot be both in South Dakota and not in South Dakota. Now, this sounds simple enough, but I'll give you one more example. Is your brain hurting yet? Maybe it checked out. Okay. We're almost done. You're in a coffee shop. You're sharing the good news with your good friend who happens to be Buddhist. And he responds to you by saying this. He says, why do you Christians always say that your view is right and all the other views are wrong? You ever come across that before? It's pretty common. Why do you have to tell me my view is wrong? This is what your friend is asking as you stir your creamer, your latte, or whatever you're drinking. Well, you could take a napkin out and draw on this formula, and you could say, A does not equal not A. And you could say to him, have you ever heard of that, this law, this logic of law called the law of non-contradiction? They may respond, yes, I've heard of it, or no, I've never heard of that before. Then you might say, given this law, if Christianity is true, as Jesus says and claims in John 14, he says, he offers the only way to salvation. In John 14, chapter 6, he says that I'm the only way. Then it cannot be true that salvation, there's other ways to salvation. If Jesus says I'm the only way, if that's A, then that means all the other ways are not a way. At this point, he might be saying, well, Christianity may be true for you, but Zen Buddhism that's true for me. So in other words, you say to him, from your point of view, A is equal to not A. Christianity is true for me, and not Christianity, that's true for you. How can that be? That violates this fundamental law called the law of non-contradiction. A cannot equal not A. Your friend replies, well, I don't believe that law anyway, that A is not equal to not A. I don't believe that. Oh, I see what you're saying. You believe then in the law of relativism, that A is in fact equal to not A. You believe, in other words, you're saying absolutism and relativism are actually equal. Yes, I guess I do. I believe A is not. I do believe that A is equal to not A. But then you say, here's your problem. In making your argument, you use the very law that you said you don't agree with. You use that law to argue your point. It's like saying, I cannot speak a word of English. In doing so, you refuted your own claim. Well, on the one hand, you just said you don't believe in absolutism, but on the other hand, you say it is equal to relativism when you say A is equal to not A. Well, I don't know about you, but my brain's hurting. I'm going to stop. But let's close by summarizing. The correspondence view of truth. Statements and reality correspond with each other. What you say and what reality, if they correspond, that was the beginning view of truth. Plato said that, talked about that. Coherence view of truth. That says that as long as your belief system and your true statement, as long as they're in that system, then that's true. And then what's true for you, you know, you have your truth, I have my truth. That comes down. That brought about relativism, which is pretty much what is taught at the university and at any level of education now. Secondly, we talked about the law of non-contradiction, how it is an extremely strong case for absolute truth. Since all religions make truth claims, they all contradict each other. They cannot all be true. Either one is true or the rest are all false, or all are false, and some other view is correct. Some people take this absolutist view, and they say, you're too intolerant. You're too narrow-minded. They'll even say, you're bigoted. I looked up the word bigoted because I've heard it talked about a lot, the idea of bigot. And I wanted to see what it means. It says, one who is obstinately and intolerantly devoted to his church, to his party, to his belief, or his opinion. In other words, you're strong and you hold to your truth and your belief. Well, the truth is truth. And if for me, adhering to that truth makes me a bigot, then I guess I'll have to own that. But here's the thing. I don't really care what label people put on. I just want to be known as someone who tries to present the truth logically, lovingly, and graciously. That's what Christians are to do. To present the truth. Not looking down at people, not judging people, but being kind and gracious and humble and inoffensive. That's what Jesus did. He took the parables, he took stories, and in lovingly and a kind, but a truthful manner, and in so doing, people marveled at him for his wisdom and his understanding. And he said, this is from God. This is not from man. Sharing and seeking the truth. Seeking and sharing the truth. It is the very enterprise of Christianity. This is what we're called to do. Let us remain committed to it as we build belief for God's glory. That's what we're doing. Paul writes in Colossians, so then, just as you receive Christ as Lord, continue to live in Him, rooted and built up in Him, strengthened in the faith as you were taught, and overflowing with thankfulness. Amen.